When Kazim Abdullah was asked to put down his beloved clarinet and pick up the baton, wow, that was not an easy decision. He decided to do it, though, and it's turned out okay. He's conducting a new recording of the full ballet Daphnis and Chloe. I hope you enjoy this story about Kazim Abdullah on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. First, I would love for you to kind of just introduce yourself to our listeners, because I know you're from Indiana originally, and music for you, really, you started diving into it when you were, what, about 10 years old or so?
Exactly, yes. I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I grew up mostly in Dayton, Ohio. And I started playing clarinet and piano at the age of 10. Yeah, for me, music was just something, you know, I was lucky that when I was in the public schools in Dayton, they were still offering, you know, music and music education, and it was always a subject that I really liked, and so as soon as I got the chance to choose an instrument, I did. I actually chose two because I liked it so much. So that was kind of my early beginnings, and then I went to Interlaken, I guess, at the age of 11, and ended up going there for actually 6 summers between 11 and 18. So, yeah, those were sort of my early musical experiences. And then I studied at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, and then continued my studies at the University of Southern California, and then actually played in the New World Symphony, Michael Tilson Thomas's training orchestra based in Miami Beach. And I played in New World Symphony for 2 years. And it was really while I was there where I made the decision to transition from being a clarinetist to a conductor. I had always kind of dabbled in conducting, done some conducting. By the time I was in New World, I had already been a conducting student at places like Aspen, but I was never sure, you know, how to really go about starting a career in that field, because it's kind of, there's no set path and structure to becoming a conductor in a way.
Was it Michael Tilson Thomas who provided some inspiration in that regard?
He did provide some inspiration. Yeah, you know, when I was playing in the orchestra and I had done a few small projects with some of my colleagues, and I had recorded them and showed them to him, and he viewed the video, and we had actually a very short conversation, but he, and I think I was like 22, 23 at the time, and he said, well, Kazim, it's clear that you're able to do this, so why aren't you doing it? And I was trying to explain to him, you know, my angst about pursuing conducting and leaving my clarinet playing behind, so to speak. And he said, well, that's the only way you'll be able to really make it, I think, as a conductor, because, you know, you really have to devote everything to it if you're going to try to do it. So you should try to make a decision soon, because it's one thing to kind of be doing both at 22, 23, and another thing to be doing it at 28, 29, which was actually really good advice. I really took that to heart, because I think it just always depends on what your musical path is, I think. So, you know, so for instance, if I was a world-renowned soloist, my entry point into conducting could be easier, and then I could probably start later. But it just always depends on the person and the musical path. But it was very good advice, and I took it.
Well, and then you went on to spend, what, maybe 3 years at the Metropolitan Opera as an assistant conductor?
Yeah, I know. Yes, I worked at Los Angeles Opera for a short period, and then went to Tanglewood, and then got the chance to work at the Met. And that was a wonderful experience, of course. Yeah, I worked with James Levine, of course, but I also worked with other conductors like Fabio Luisi and Lauren Mazel, Louis Langres, Kirill Petrenko. So, you know, it was funny to sort of work with so many different conductors and different time periods of their lives, and to see how they worked with the orchestra was really phenomenal. So, I mean, just to give you an example, when I was working with Kirill Petrenko, he was a freelance conductor. And of course, now he's becoming more well known as the new music director of Berlin Philharmonic. So when you're assisting someone like that, he's not so much older than me, maybe 10 years. And so, you know, one learns a lot from that experience. So my time at the Met was actually really great. I learned a lot.
So I'm curious, is there maybe one thing, one thread that really sticks with you, having spent time with all these different conductors, that just maybe kept getting reinforced, that you maybe use on a daily basis as you are a conductor?
I think the thing that has always stuck with me is being a conductor, you have to both know when to intervene and when to really guide, and know when to let people free to express the music as they understand it. So it's always finding this balance of helping people to bring their best to a performance, rehearsal situation, but leading and guiding in a way so that it's always both subtle and direct, and always just listening and being inspired by what's coming at you musically.
Well, I want to talk about this Ravel recording and the ballet Daphnis and Chloe. At the time that you made this recording, you were still serving as music director of the city of Aachen, Germany. Why did you want to record this ballet, Daphnis and Chloe, by Ravel?
The recording is actually made from a live concert. So every other year, there's a choir biennale in Aachen. They invite choruses from all over the world to take part in this choir biennale. So they usually invite maybe 2, 3, 4 guest choirs from around the world. And that year, we had a guest choir from Ukraine, and then a guest choir from Utah. And so they complimented the choirs from Aachen, and we did this piece, Daphnis and Chloe. And we'd been recording the concerts, and, you know, when I listened to it, I thought, wow, this sounds just very good. And, yeah, you know, the quality of the chorus singing, yeah, you know, even though it was a number of different choirs, the way they ended up coming together and blending, I thought was very impressive, especially when I heard other recordings of the piece. I thought, oh, wow, this chorus really brought it home.
Let me ask you, what role does the chorus play in this ballet?
They never speak words, but they express with the voice. And, like, you know, this is a very old story, the story of Daphnis and Chloe, and I always think, you know, one gets the feeling Ravel was trying to evoke a time before maybe there was real speech. You know what I mean? Before there was real language, and, like, maybe just, you know, people communicating with just their eyes and their facial expressions and their body movement, which is what ballet is and what makes ballet so special, because it's all about the visual, the face, the body expression, the body movement. And so for Ravel to have a wordless chorus sort of speaks volumes, because it gives emphasis to certain feelings, whether they are feelings of barbarity. Yeah, like, you know, there are a couple of conflicts between groups of people and between individuals, and often those are supported by barbaric grunts and chants. And then there are moments where the chorus gives a feeling and an aura of a halo of love and of a kind of a warmth. I mean, there's one spot in the score where he writes, Daphnis and Chloe, they look at each other and lock eyes, and the chorus just releases this wonderful, warm, glowing ah. There's no words, but in the expression actually of the music, so much is kind of expressed about this connection and love between these two people that have just locked eyes. And, you know, and that's probably, if you think about it, that's been part of what it is to be human since we became human. And one doesn't need words for that.
It's funny because when you think about that, like if we were hearing this music in a movie, if, you know, demonstrated through like movie music, it might be cheesy. But here in this ballet, it just has this lush atmospheric feel to it when the chorus comes in.
Yes. I don't know, there are just wonderful, beautiful moments like that, like where one thinks, oh man, something like that must come from heaven, and it's like the ancestors of these people singing and supporting this union or something. I don't know, but I know what you mean. Sometimes it could be cheesy, but in this context, it's not.
Well, the ballet is in three different tableaus, and I was wondering if you could just kind of, you know, give us maybe a highlight from each of those tableaus that you really look forward to when you're listening to this music or conducting this music.
Well, yes. So, for instance, the first tableau just sort of establishes the space and atmosphere. It takes place in this grotto, and there's a crowd of youngsters, and they bow before nymphs, and the girls are dancing. Daphnis is a little bit jealous of Chloe because she's flirting with some of the various younger men in the crowd. And then there's already the first confrontation with a cowherd, which is the second scene in the tableau. Chloe rejects this cowherd. But then Daphnis comes and makes an amazing impression. And that's when they fall in love, and that's when we really feel this, hear this first really warm, glowing music from the chorus. Then in the second tableau, this is where there is a huge conflict between pirates and, I guess, the community that Daphnis and Chloe are in. It's mostly highlighted by this kind of warlike dance that happens in the eighth scene, I believe. And then at the end of this scene, what happens is that Chloe is captured by these pirates. And then she has to do a wonderful sort of seductive dance, but she's trying to do the seductive dance in order to actually escape from the pirates, which she manages to do. And the final tableau, the third tableau, is sort of the most famous one, and that basically starts off with day breaking. And Daphnis and Chloe are reunited. And then you have this scene with Pan. Like, you know, Pan plays the flute, and there's this, and this shepherd, I guess he's explaining also in this scene that Pan intervened in the memory of his own love of the nymph Syrinx. So this is where we get into Pan and Syrinx, and so the couple, Daphnis and Chloe, during this big flute solo, basically what they're doing is they're miming the tale of Pan's courtship of Syrinx, whom he enchanted with a flute of reeds. And And then before an altar, Daphnis pledges his love for Chloe. And then basically the end is, they basically just sort of tenderly embrace. And the entire village joins in a wild, joyous dance.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. Download other episodes from wherever you get your favorite podcasts.